Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Van Leer Jerusalem series on ideas. Subscribe to the series on Apple, Spotify, or your favorite podcast platform. I'm Renee Garfinkel, your host, and I'm very pleased today to welcome Deborah Court to our microphones to talk about two of her new books, which she wrote with a co-author. One is The Israeli Druze Community in Transition, and the brand new book is Insider, Outsider, Research and Qualitative Inquiry, New Perspectives on Method and Meaning. Professor Deborah Court is on the Faculty of Education at Bar-Ilan University and academic consultant to the Arab Academic College in Haifa. She researches educational cultures, specializing in religious education, multiculturalism, and qualitative research methodologies. Professor Randa Kher Abbas, who cannot be with us today, the co-author, is the head of the Arab Academic College in Haifa. Her research centers on Druze identity, the cultural, religious, and family structure of the Druze community, and the changes in them as modernization sweeps the community. Deborah, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Renee. I'm very happy to be here, and I'm sorry that Randa won't be with us. Both of these books are very much communal efforts. We are partners in the research that that both of these books present in different ways.
Well, I hope she'll be feeling better soon.
Thank you.
Each of you brought very different backgrounds and expertises to this project. Let's begin by talking about how those differences impacted your work.
Well, in fact, those differences propelled our work. It's the differences between us are what make us such wonderful research partners. And I don't know if you had a chance to read the introduction to the second book on insider-outsider research, but there we talk about how we met. And this is more than 20 years ago now. I was teaching in Bar-Ilan, and I was teaching a master's class in qualitative research. Late at night, everyone is tired. Everyone wants to go home. They've been teaching all day. And I see in this huge class of about 40 students, this one particular woman with this light in her eyes, who is hanging on every word and who asks intelligent questions. And at the end of the class, I asked her if she would stay behind. And she told me later that she thought, oh no, what have I done? Why do I have to stay behind? And I asked her if she was on the thesis track. And she said, no, I'm a teacher. I'm just doing a non-thesis. And I said, no, you're supposed to be a researcher. And we're going to go and change you into the master's track. And we did that. And then she went on to become the first Druze woman to get a PhD from the Bar-Ilan's Faculty of Education. And already in her master's study, she was doing what she loves to do, which is try to understand better her own community and present it to the world. She did that in her master's thesis and then in her PhD thesis. And then from that point, we became, first of all, very good friends and research partners. And the first book on the Druze community is based on a research grant we got from the Ministry of Education, who put out a call for researchers to research what they called the generation gap in the Druze community. And we see it a little differently, as you've seen in the book, that it's not so much a gap as a bridge between the two generations. So maybe I'm answering too much to one question, but that's sort of the background of how we work together.
Well, your choice of subjects, the two of you choosing the subject, couldn't be more timely because we live in this age of identity politics, and people do have complex multiple identities. What did you set out to examine? I'm particularly interested in the three levels of identity that you looked at.
Okay, so we first of all, when we did the big research, which involved a lot of people, 60 people of sort of parental or almost grandparental age, and 60 younger people in their late teens and 20s, the Ministry of Education wanted to know what kind of gap is there in the identity, in the beliefs, in the goals and aspirations of these two groups of Druze people in such a changing time when the Druze are being propelled into the modern world, kind of like it or not. I would say that we discovered these identity levels rather than that being our goal. We set out to find this gap, and we didn't exactly find a gap. We found people with overlapping identities that are certainly shifting as the generations move along. But as you see in the book, everyone's first identity is Druze, even if they're completely unreligious. And the second identity is often Israeli. There were differences between the two generations in that, but people are Druze, they're Israeli, and they're Arab, because that is their native language, and language is a central part of our identity. So we didn't exactly set out to look at these levels, but it's kind of what we found.
Now, the Druze, many of our listeners may not have ever heard of the Druze. They are one of the many ethnic and religious minorities in Israel. And as you say, they are Arabs, but not Muslims. Their religion is Druze. How large a group are they?
I'm sorry, how what?
How large? What are their numbers in Israel?
Okay, so there are Druze all over the world. The largest communities are in the Middle East, obviously. I'm trying to put my finger on the latest numbers for Israel. I don't have them in front of my actual fingers, but it's a few. Wait a second. Okay, today there are approximately 143,000 Druze living in Israel, which is 1.6% of Israel's total population. That's as of 2019. There are also Druze communities in Syria, Lebanon, and Jordan, as well as smaller communities in places as far-flung as Australia, Canada, various European countries, and even Latin America. So this is not a huge group of people by any means, which makes it even more remarkable that they, despite changing times and modernization, they continue to be Druze. These are not people who are converting away from being Druze or intermarrying. This is a tightly knit community, which is fascinating because really up until now, up until the last couple of generations, it's been their religion that has held them together. And the religion is going, let's say, underground. Fewer and fewer people actually call themselves religious, as you can see in the book, because being religious, especially for women, means following certain rules that are harder and harder to follow in the modern world. So, the fact that people remain Druze and Druze communities remain so strong is rather remarkable. And I don't know if there's anything else like it in history. So,
well, tell us a little bit about their beliefs and practices.
Okay, so as you said, the Druze are not Muslim. They split off from Islam more than 1,000 years ago, and their religion is secret. No one can know, other than religious Druze, what exactly is at the heart of the Druze religion. In Judaism, we talk about a fence around the Torah. Well, there's a fence around the core beliefs of the Druze as well, in terms of their dress, their absolute loyalty to their family and their community, that even if they're not religious, it sort of holds the religious safe inside. So there are core beliefs that we can talk about. One of these is reincarnation, which is absolutely central to their identity, and which is also a partial explanation for why they managed to stay a community. A Druze soul is reincarnated as another Druze soul when a person dies. It doesn't become something else, a Christian or anything else, and also no one can convert into being a Druze. It's a closed community of souls that continues from generation to generation. And even those who are not religious hold this core belief absolutely in their hearts. So that's part of the reason. Another thing that affects their, I don't know if this is their religion, but that affects their unity as a community is the fact that they do not have and have never had a home country. So they've always been beleaguered and besieged. And so part of their, and this is kind of a religious belief, part of their core beliefs is that they must protect one another, the protection of the brotherhood, they call it, against all of these opposing forces around them. You can't really say what their religion is. They revere family and community. They believe absolutely in reincarnation. But the core beliefs of the religion are not revealed unless one is actually a religious Druze, and there are fewer and fewer.
There are fewer and fewer religious Druze or fewer and fewer Jews?
No, fewer and fewer religious Druze, which is all the more remarkable that the Druze marry the Druze. They continue living in their communities. They continue doing the fence of values around their religion, like taking care of their parents and staying loyal to their communities. That is absolutely what's holding them together. One of the questions we ask at the end of our book is, how long can that go on? How long can when people are not keeping the dress code, for instance, especially women, how long will the community be able to sustain itself? And when there are fewer and fewer people who actually know the core beliefs and practice them, how long will it last? Can it last? Will the values be enough? That's, I think, the big question with which we end that book.
Does the community allow people to marry out?
No, absolutely not. There's no marrying out. There's no marrying in.
There's
no sex before marriage. These are sacrosanct values, and they protect the community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was really intrigued by the integration of the identity variables. People define themselves as Druze Israeli, sometimes mm-hmm. Israeli Druze, and their language is Arabic Hebrew or Hebrew Arabic, depending. And it just seems so seamless for them, whereas for example, the Israeli Arab Muslims seem to have a much harder time integrating all the aspects of their identity. Now, why do you think that is?
Okay. Well, certainly a big part of that, probably the major part of that, is that the Druze serve in the army. The Druze, because they have no country, are loyal to whatever country they live in. They're loyal to their homeland. The Syrian Druze are loyal to Syria. The Israeli Druze are absolutely loyal to Israel. Sometimes they even call, Randa calls herself a Zionist. Because they serve in the army and are integrated in that way, and because they are very, very patriotic, I think that's at least part of the explanation.
Mm-hmm. And you think that happened because they didn't have a homeland ever in the 1,000 years since they split from Islam?
Uh-huh. Yeah, because they used to be Muslims, right? And then they broke away from Islam because of their own beliefs and their own. I mean, that's a whole other story, which I wish Randa was here to tell it. But because of that, because wherever they go, they're a minority, and sometimes persecuted. Part of the way they protect themselves is to be very, very patriotic and loyal to the country they live in. And most Israeli Druze, certainly not all, really do feel themselves strongly Israeli.
Yes, and Israeli Jews feel that way about the Druze also.
Absolutely. Brothers in arms and brothers in citizenship. There's no question.
Right. Now, you very interestingly quote some of your subjects, and that really warms up the book. And one of those subjects, Sada, she said, this is a quote, "Our faith comforts us with lenient thoughts about death. Death is a matter of fate.
Yes.
That is the kind of faith that exists only with us." Can you explain what she means about lenient thoughts?
Okay. Yes. This refers to reincarnation. I think all of us in every faith, you know, we wonder, we may have beliefs about what happens after death, but we're not sure. And we have to wait and see. The Druze absolutely believe that their soul will be reincarnated. It is not any kind of a question. And this is very comforting. We heard this from a few people, including young people who did not claim to be in any way religious, but they all said, "My faith comforts me and I'm not afraid of death, because I know that my soul will go to another Druze body when I die."
That's remarkable comfort.
Yeah.
Yes, you describe most of the Druze as secular. And nevertheless, the subjects that you've spoke to often talk about their obligation to keep the secrets of the religion. Mm-hmm. Although those who are secular don't know the religion's secrets, do they?
Yeah, no, that's true. That's a little bit of that's interesting. It's a little bit of a contradiction.
Yes.
So they don't know the secrets, but they're determined to keep them. And the way they protect them, I think maybe keep isn't even the right word. Protect is better. And the way they protect is by holding to the values, which is only marrying Druze. Not having sex before marriage, being extremely loyal to the community and to the extended family. This is that fence around the secrets. So even if they don't know the secrets, they're protecting them by staying Druze and protecting their Druze community.
And that's a powerful enough force for people who say they're not religious to, after all, the Druze go out into the world. They go to university. They even go to high school outside of the community, some of them. And they presumably fall in love. And nevertheless, they will stick to protecting their community and their religion, which they don't practice.
Look, so far, it's a powerful enough force. And obviously, we hope that it will remain so. It's fairly early days in terms of modernization. There's only a couple of generations, and I'd like to say something about girls. There's only a couple of generations of young women who are going out to university. And this automatically, or almost automatically, has them not being allowed to be religious, because you can't have a driving license to be a Druze woman. If you do, you're outside the religion. You can't mix with, you can't be in mixed company, mixed non-Druze company. You can only, theoretically, you're only supposed to leave the town in the company of a first degree male relative, a father, a brother, or a husband. So living in the modern world, and more people have to. They can't make a living from agriculture anymore. People have to work. And that doesn't mean that there aren't families where the woman does stay home, and there are cottage industries that women do in the towns, and the husband goes out, and he's less restricted in terms of his behavior. But these changes are real, and they're growing as the world moves ever forward. So this is the big question. How many more generations until there is more intermarriage? I'm not saying there's no intermarriage. Probably it happens, but it is absolutely forbidden. And it's a huge step to do that and to leave your community behind. As these things inevitably begin to happen more and more, who knows what will happen? Who knows?
Right. You can't predict it.
Nope.
Let's look, while we're on the religion topic, let's look for a moment at the issue of religious fundamentalism. Now, all over the world, one problematic response to the threat of modernization has been religious fundamentalism. Is that found in the Druze community?
No, there's absolutely not. there are certainly people who are deeply religious and who follow all the rules, but I don't think that's called fundamentalism. No.
Well, that's surprising in itself. And your research focused on the differences or agreements between the older and younger generations, and you found a remarkable level of agreement in values.
Yes.
How do you explain that? To what do you attribute that?
Well, I think it's explained by the history of the Druze, by the fact that they've been a closed community, not only through their belief in reincarnation, a closed community of souls, but also because they don't have a homeland. They have always had to stick together and support each other to hold off the surrounding forces. And perhaps right now the surrounding forces are not people who want to kill them, but people who want to make them leave behind their faith and become part of the bigger world. So their history has protected them. And again, the question is, for how long?
About a fifth of the older respondents say they are religious. That's 20% even of
yes.
the elders. And others define themselves as guardians of traditions and values.
Yes.
Tell us about the difference between those two phrases.
Okay. So someone who actually is religious is someone who follows all the rules and thus is allowed to do the deep secret learning in the Hilwa, in the house of worship. He or she is allowed to open the holy books and see what's written inside. I'd like to say that Randa, her mother, was religious. And Randa inherited from her mother the holy books, which to this day sit on Randa's shelf. She touches them sometimes, and she has never opened them because Randa is not religious. She's an academic world, a woman of the academic world. She goes to conferences. She mingles with people at, at Van Leer and at the Ministry of Education. But she reveres her religion, even though she doesn't know what's inside it. So, these behaviors seem to be very strong, and this guarding of whatever the secrets might be by more and more people who can't go into the secrets, it seems to be incredibly strong.
It's really remarkable that curiosity didn't overcome the wow.
Yes.
Well, they're quite distinctive, and and what would you say are the implications of what you found in the Druze for the impact of modern or postmodern reality on other traditional societies
yes.
elsewhere?
This is an important question because the Druze are a very specific and special group of people, but many people all over the world, many so-called traditional cultures are having the inevitable meeting with modernity. And they're all facing parallel issues. How far out can I go? How much can I become part of this world with technology and dress and driving and meeting all kinds of people and still retain something of who I was or who my ancestors were? Many tradition, if not all, traditional communities are dealing with these same issues.
Yeah, it's and apparently not quite as successfully as the Druze do.
I guess there are varying degrees. One of the famous theories about this whole area says that change is path dependent. I really like that phrase, path dependent. And mm-hmm. research is showing across the world that traditional cultures which begin to go out and have to form a new path for themselves that makes sense in the modern world, don't leave their own path completely. They forge a new path which retains many of the values and much of the behaviors so that they kind of learn how to still be themselves in the modern world.
Right. That's the challenge. And it's good that groups are learning how to do it.
Yeah.
I want to thank you for sharing your work in this distinctive and very likable community. But before I let you go, let's take an extra moment to talk about your forthcoming book. Or is it out yet? Or it's about?
I have it in front of me. Yeah, I have it. Yeah.
Okay. Insider, Outsider Research in Qualitative Inquiry.
Yes.
Now, I'm guessing that this book emerged from your experience in working on the Drew's book.
Yeah,
but maybe
it
I'm
absolutely
wrong.
Did. Yeah. And that's why I said that these two books are kind of companion books. And what we do in the second book, Insider Outsider Research and Qualitative Inquiry, is we try to derive from our own experience of this large study methodological implications for the whole business of a call it a research partnership, where one person is an insider to the culture being studied and the other person is an outsider. Not just there's a lot of insider-outsider research where a group is put together, you know, because you want somebody on the inside and you want somebody with the academic knowledge. We call ourselves partners because we're deeply connected, Randa and I, and we've been working together for 20 years. And we think it's a special kind of relationship with implications for others who want to study culture. Culture is amazingly complex, and you can see things from the inside that you cannot see from the outside, and vice versa. And one right. of the fascinating things we detail in this book through examples of our various studies is that Randa understands things implicitly that I would never in the world be able to understand. And also sometimes she's blind to those things because she's too close to them. And I sometimes have an outsider view that allows me to ask questions that that she wouldn't think to ask because things are so obvious. And the combination of these two kinds of knowledge and these two kinds of viewpoint, together with deep discussions as we do our studies, has, I think, enabled us to come to rich understanding of the Drew's culture, which neither an insider alone nor an outsider alone, I think, could have come to.
Well, that's really very wise. I think that clearly corresponds to common sense, that someone who is embedded in a group is both more able to deeply feel what's going on, but maybe can overlook what's going on compared to the outside view. So it's really a brilliant combination, and it sounds like it's been a very productive and enjoyable partnership.
Yes, and it continues to be.
That's great. Well, I wish you a lot of luck with both books, and thank you very much for coming on the show today.
Thank you, Renee. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
And thanks to our researcher, Bela Pasikov. Bye-bye.